Media WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Okie dokie. Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, February 7th, 2010. We have a great show for you today. We're going to be joined live on the phones by Sut Jolly, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts and best known as the executive director of the Media Education Foundation, one of the great media literacy organizations in the United States. Today, we'll be talking about their work, some of their documentaries on media literacy, media education, and the world in general of media with Sut Jolly. Before we go to our guests, though, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
President Barack Obama reaffirmed his strong commitment to maintaining an open and neutral internet during a crowdsourced interview conducted on YouTube. It was the first interview given by the president since his State of the Union speech. As a follow-up to the speech, YouTube collected questions and votes for 5 days. More than 55,000 submitted and voted on both video and text questions. 11,696 questions were submitted. Obama answered a question about network neutrality from James Earlywine of Indianapolis. Earlywine's question received more than 1,300 votes, placing it at the top of the list in the jobs and economy category. The question was read by YouTube's Steve Grove.
I got to tell you, the number one question that came in the jobs and economy category had to do with the internet. And it came from James Earlywine, Indianapolis. He said, an open internet is a powerful engine for economic growth and new jobs. Letting large companies block and filter online content and services would stifle needed growth. What is your commitment to keeping the internet open and neutral in America?
Well, I'm a big believer in net neutrality. I campaigned on this. I continue to be a strong supporter of it. My FCC chairman, Julius Genachowski, has indicated that he shares the view that we've got to keep the internet open, that we don't want to create a bunch of gateways that prevent somebody who doesn't have a lot of money but has a good idea from being able to start their next YouTube or their next Google on the internet. So this is something we're committed to. We're getting pushback, obviously, from some of the bigger carriers who would like to be able to charge more fees and extract more money from wealthier customers. But we think that runs counter to the whole spirit of openness that has made the internet such a powerful engine for not only economic growth, but also for the generation of ideas and creativity.
Howard Zinn, historian, author, playwright, and educator, died last week at the age of 87. Zinn is best known for writing A People's History of the United States, in which he celebrated the historical contributions of workers, women, and people of color. In 2002, Howard Zinn made this recording for Seattle's Reclaim the Media.
This is Howard Zinn, and I'd like to tell you something about media and democracy. George Orwell wrote the lines, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." He understood that if you can control what people know about history, if you can decide what gets in and what is left out, you can order their thinking. You can order their values. You can, in effect, organize their brains by controlling their knowledge. The people who dominate today's big media networks, who publish school textbooks, who decide upon the dominant ideas in our culture, are mostly rich white men. Not surprisingly, they ask that history concentrate on those who are rich and white and male. That is why the point of view of black people has not been a very important one in the telling of our history. Same with women's perspectives or those of working people. Most of what we get from mainstream media and from standard history books is ideological, biased not in favor of the people, but towards the commercial and political interests of the men and corporations at the top. When the New York Times interprets events in a certain way, whether by describing a nonviolent demonstration as a riot or by failing to critique government foreign policy claims, that interpretation becomes history. It becomes a record people will turn to in the future to find out about the past. That's why media voices from outside the mainstream have been so important throughout American history, even if they are left out of history's official version. There have been periods in American history when pamphlets and newspapers have had an important effect in arousing and organizing a movement. Back during the anti-slavery movement, abolitionists spread literature all over the country, so much so that President Andrew Jackson ordered the Postmaster General to bar abolitionist literature from the southern states. Earlier in this century, there were thriving labor newspapers providing a counterpoint to the business-run press. Today, community radio stations and alternative publications are still found all over the country. Satellite TV and the Internet make it easier to distribute alternative media to audiences in distant homes and libraries. These community-based media resources are increasingly important as critical voices are silenced or pushed to the margins by the mainstream. By letting these voices speak, the alternative media preserve crucial parts of today's history and challenge powerful institutions' right to control the future.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today, February 7th, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Before we go to today's guest, I have an important announcement, so please take note. 2 weeks from today, for the first time in our eight-year history, we're going to have a live version with a studio audience of Media Matters. We're going to have it at the Siebel Center at 201 North Goodwin Avenue on the campus of the University of Illinois. And it will be a free event. We do the show live, and John Nichols, my often guest host here on the program, will be joining us. John and I will start the show at 12:30 to the studio audience. We'll do our usual 1-2 live program with all the questions that day coming pretty much from the studio audience. And then we will have more after the show ends with John and I talking about our new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, and taking questions and comments from people in the audience. It's free. We invite people to come. We're hoping to get a big crowd. And if people do want to purchase a copy of The Death and Life of American Journalism, it will be for sale, and every penny will go to WILL. Every penny will go to benefit the station that carries this program. We do hope you'll come out. It'll be a great time. John Nichols is driving down all the way to join us. He's eager to do it. It's going to be a great time. So put that in your calendars. 2 weeks from today, February 21st, live version of Media Matters. Starting at 12:30, we'll have the theater will be open at the Siebel Center, and the show will be live 1-2, and we'll be there for a couple hours to talk to all of you, and we'd love to have a lot of people there. If you do want to go there, it's free, as I said, but tickets are urged, requested, and all you need to do is call 217-333-7300. Put in your request, and you'll get a ticket sent to you, as many tickets as you want. And parking is available, so as you know, in the area at the garage, the Goodwin and Clark Streets. So please keep that in mind 2 weeks from today. Okie dokie. Our guest today is one of our favorite guests in Media Matters history. We've had him on a few times. He is Sut Jolly, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, and also the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, perhaps the leading media literacy material or media criticism producing group in the United States today. Sut, welcome to Media Matters.
Yeah, good afternoon, Bob.
And you have actually been a witness. Last week, John Nichols and I had the privilege of going to Amherst and speaking before a number of your colleagues and students at the University of Massachusetts. So you know what our guests, our listeners will be in store for if they show up 2 weeks from today to hear our program live.
Yeah, no, it was a great event. I encourage people to go. I heard nothing but positive things from both my my faculty colleagues and also, more importantly, from students about the importance of dealing with these issues around journalism and democracy.
Well, Sut Jolly, let's start with the Media Education Foundation. I think there, most people, certainly students and faculty, but even people outside the academy, have probably seen or heard about some of the videos your group produced, but without really knowing that the group that's behind them is the Media Education Foundation. What is the Media Education Foundation? When is it founded? A little bit of the history, if you would.
The Media Education Foundation was founded. I founded it about, it's actually almost 20 years ago now. Seems like a long, long time ago. And the aim of the Media Education Foundation is to make accessible really important ideas to do with media, culture, and democracy. I see our aim as kind of translating the cutting-edge research that's produced in academia and to put it into an accessible format. So you don't have to be, you know, an academic. We don't have to read academic journals, to get this.
Go ahead, Sat.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, roughly how many videos has the Media Education Foundation produced in its history, and roughly how many do you'd like to do every year?
We must have done, I never kind of count these things, so they always change by the month almost. But our catalog has around 50 or 60 films in it now. And we both produce our own films, but we also distribute some other films as well. And we hope to produce like four or five a year, actually. That's our aim, to kind of keep it going.
What has been your biggest or most popular film or films that you've produced, videos?
I think the Media Education Foundation, actually, I think is most probably the leading provider of videos and films to do with media and cultural issues on university campuses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always amazed when I go and speak somewhere, at how many different departments come to my talk and say they use our materials. And librarians actually say that our materials are some of the most popular things that go out. So the films that we produce actually do get used, and they get used where we want them to be used, which is in the classroom. Which actually these days, and I'm sure you're aware of this. As the spaces for discussion of important issues close down, there's fewer and fewer places in the culture where you can talk about these things. And actually, the classroom is one of them. The classroom is one of the last kind of independent places left in the culture where you can raise important issues. And we hope that our films will allow people to, to discuss these important issues.
Our guest, Sat Jala, Executive Director of the Media Education Foundation, Professor of Communication, Scholar, Author, Teacher at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, joining us live today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sat, what are the, in the history of the Media Education Foundation, what have been your best selling or most seen videos?
I think there's two that stand out above the rest. And they're both to do with gender. The highest-selling title we have is Killing Us Softly 3, which is a film focused on the work of Jean Kilbourne that looks at images of women in advertising. And I think it's not an overstatement to say that that film has literally, changed the lives of millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
We get letters all the time, and Jean gets letters all the time about how once they've seen the film, people kind of look at the world in a new way. And the other film is a companion piece somewhat, but it deals with a related issue, which is images of masculinity. And the film is called Tough Guys, and it's the guys is G-U-I-S-E, which deals with the kind of guy, the disguise that boys and men are encouraged to take on as they perform masculinity. And those things are very importantly linked to control, to intimidation, and ultimately to violence.
Do you get much blowback to the feminist work and the stuff questioning gender roles from people who find that inappropriate?
We don't, actually. As I said, most of our sales, actually, most of the films we distribute are to do with that gender work. The films that both Killing Us Softly and Tough Guys, they're not really radical films. They kind of put into an accessible form what a lot of people actually are thinking already, but they just don't have the language to express. And so I think the reason our films are successful, those films are successful, is not that they're radical works that are out on the edge, is that they're actually just a little bit removed from center, but they address really important issues that people have in their minds that they just haven't crystallized around. So I've always been surprised that we don't get a lot of blowback on that gender stuff. I mean, we're distributing a new film on pornography, And I guess that's the one we would most probably have most amount of kind of feedback on, just because of the nature of the subject matter.
Yeah, but
even then, I'm surprised at how little there has been.
What is the MEF take on pornography?
Well, I wouldn't say it's our take. We're distributing a film by actually one of my former grad students. Her name is Ching Sun. And she did a film called The Price of Pleasure. And it really looks at pornography. I think the film is really good because it tries to get past kind of the free speech issues. It tries to get past the simple-minded way we've looked at it in the past, which says these images directly lead to violence or to sexual violence. And instead looks, asks the question, what is pornography doing to our relationships?
Mm-hmm.
How does it impact upon the lives that, that ordinary men and women, not people who are violent, but the lives that ordinary men and women live? How does it integrate itself into our romantic and our sexual imaginations? And it gives, a pretty troubling answer to that. It's a different kind of take on pornography than I think many people are used to.
When will that video be available?
It's already available. That's been out for about nine months or a year now. So, and it's it's doing relatively well despite its subject matter. Again, given its subject matter, it's tough to avoid very very disturbing images. That's one of the things I've always believed in: is if you're going to look at a subject matter, you've got to look at it. You can't just kind of describe it and hope people know what you're talking about. And the reason we look at whatever subject matter we look at is because it's popular. I think if you're looking at subject matter that is, on the margins, it's not really that relevant. But when you're looking at issues in popular culture, you're looking at images that, literally millions and millions of people are seeing every single day, then if you want to talk to young people, you've got to be in that language. You've got to show what you're talking about. And in fact, I think the most significant thing about the pornography film is, because I'm sure, as you know, this is as soon as you get into pornography, it's a minefield of potential issues. With liberals who are concerned about free speech, with conservatives who are concerned about morality, even with feminists who are concerned about having a too restrictive kind of definition around sexuality. So it's really a minefield. And it's tough sometimes to get any kind of, reasonable debate going. And I think what the film tries to do is to say, look, hold on a second. Let's just look at the pornography. Let's look at the stuff that is the most popular. Not what may be on the margins, not what may be esoteric. But what are the most popular DVDs out there? What are the most popular websites? And then let's see what those websites say, and then ask the really important question, which is not only what effect do these images have, but I actually think a much more important question, which is why are they so popular? With these very disturbing images around, and a lot of them around, violence and humiliation and degradation, the question I think we have to ask is, why are these things so popular? What are they tapping into within the audience that allows them, to achieve such popularity?
What is the answer that they offer in the video?
Well, I think the answer is it's a complicated answer. I'm not too sure the video itself answers this question. But a very important recent work. I'm not too sure if you haven't had him on, you should have him on. Michael Kimmel, who's a gender studies specialist. Wrote a book called Guyland, which is about the world that men from about the ages of 18 to about 27 inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
And he argues, in fact, that what's going on is a kind of backlash against the gains of feminism, and that in the world of pornography, young men who are largely the market for these kinds of messages and these images. Young men are finding a world that they thought was gone, a world in which they're in control, a world in which women will do whatever they want to do. And so the answer that Michael Kimmel gives is actually it's revenge and it's compensation for a world that's changed radically in the last 20 years as a result of the women's movement, as a result of other movements that have made things in many ways much more democratic.
Our guest today is Sat Jolly from the Media Education Foundation and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's joining us live from the phone here on Media Matters at WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with any questions or comments for Sat Jolly, the telephone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Sat, the Media Education Foundation website for people who want to learn more about MEF is
www.mediaed.org.
Or you can just go to a search engine and enter Media Education Foundation, and it'll be the first entry, as I discovered.
All right. Okay, good.
Yeah, you're right there.
Yeah, all our films are actually available, you know, for people to preview online. So you can actually watch our entire films online. There's a low quality version there. So if people are interested, but you know you don't have the money to buy it, you can still get the information by looking at our previews.
You know, you talked about how the issues that you like to discuss in the films that you do, like pornography, I assume, is Exhibit A, but there are many others, are issues that are basically not discussed elsewhere in society outside of the classroom, or increasingly, I think you put it, are left to the classroom, that they've been closed out of other forms of discussion. And I assume that's a fair paraphrase of what you just said. What are some of the other really important issues that you want to tackle and you have tackled at Media Education Foundation that you think are getting short shrift elsewhere?
Well, I think the most important, probably, is we did a film that came out about a year ago to do with the commercialization of childhood,
mm-hmm.
called Consuming Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that issue of not just commercialization in general, which I think is a very important issue, which the media, by definition, can't deal with because they're funded by advertisers. And so advertisers and commercial interests have zero interest in having any kind of critical discussion around commercialism. And then more specifically, what we did that's been a focus of my work for quite a while. And then in the film Consuming Kids, we look specifically at what's happened actually in the last 15 years, whereby children who were at one point kind of considered outside of the market have become increasingly the target for advertising and for commercialization, and they grow up now. I'm using your term now. I mean, it's a hyper commercial environment within which they grow up. That is radically different to what it was even 10 years ago. And again, the film looks at how we've essentially as a culture allowed advertisers and corporations to take aim at our kids, and to turn them into lobbyists for products inside the home. And again, you won't see that kind of discussion going on in the mainstream media, precisely because of who funds mainstream media.
So, Jolly, what do you make of the argument that sometimes comes up that that advertising might be flourishing right now, but with the new technologies coming along, the sort of old style of advertising is disappearing, and maybe advertising in general is disappearing because people have much more power over their communication environments, including children, because they can pick from infinite number of websites and iPod songs and text messages to deal with and tweets. So the traditional control that the Madison Avenue and commercial interests had, sort of monopolizing their brain cells, is disappearing.
Well, I think you just have to look to see what's happening to that, the so-called new media. I mean, again, advertisers and commercial interests, I mean, they, by definition, they have to go to where the audience is. I mean, if they want to sell products, if they didn't try and sell products, they would go. I mean, capitalism would fall into a depression even worse than it's doing right now. And so, on pain of death, they have to make sure that they can stimulate demand in some way. So they have no option but to go where the audience has gone. And so, if the audience has gone somewhere else, if the audience has gone, online, if the audience has gone, to iPod, if the audience has gone to Facebook, if the audience has gone, that is where advertisers will go. And so increasingly what you're seeing, not increasingly, I mean, it's part of the nature of online communication. You're seeing the same kinds of commercialization there as you would in more traditional media. So it's not as though there's less commercialization. It's just expanding to the places where people actually are.
Is this, when you do a film like, produce a film like Consuming Kids, the commercialization of childhood, and chronicle, you know, a problem, and we've discussed it here on Media Matters. I think it's at least twice a year we have experts on this subject. It's a real concern of ours. We've had Alan Kanner. We've had Liz Shore.
Judy Shore
on the air to discuss it. Susan Lynn, many other people in the last year or two, including yourself. And the issue that I think this is one issue that virtually everyone gets when they think about it, and every student I have gets it because they live it. But invariably, the question everyone has is, was there anything we could possibly do about it? I mean, okay, thanks for alerting me to the situation. It's really interesting, and I agree that it's really troubling. But, you know, it seems like there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. How do you respond when you get I assume you get that question, and when you do, how do you respond?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to respond because it's, in one sense, you know, it hits at a truth. I mean, I think the most fundamental thing is for people to become aware of it. That's, you know, step number one. And then step number two is when people realize that the world is constructed. I mean, when I teach, you know, in my classes, what I want students to get out of it at the end, you know, it's not a particular set of ideas or, you know, a particular content I want them to get out of it. I want them to understand that the world is constructed by someone, and you can either, you know, participate actively in that construction, therefore battle and struggle and contest what the world looks like, or you can kind of sit back and say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do, you know, it's just and allow someone else to construct the world. And I'm, you know, for me, I what I tell my students is, I'm not going to tell you what you should be doing, but don't tell me that you're innocent in the world. You know, there's no such thing as innocent. You know, everyone is involved. Everyone is implicit. You know, everyone has a role within the world that's constructed. And once you do that, then I think people can find all kinds of ways in which to, you know, which to contest and which to struggle. I mean, one of the most important, I think, is if you think about, you mentioned Susan Lynn, you know, and their center, the Center for the Child Free, for Commercial Free Childhood. I think has done incredible work. They've done it by trying to organize parents against particular campaigns. You know, and just recently, Disney had to come out and say essentially all those Baby Einstein videos that we sold you—they're absolutely worthless—and that, you know, they're talking now about refunding money. Well, that came about as a pressure, as a result of coordinated pressure from groups like, you know, like the Campaign for a Commercial Free Childhood. So I think people just have to, you know, get past this notion there's nothing they can do. There's always something you can do. And you have to do it collectively. And if you do it, that's the way to, you know, to struggle against a world that seems to be way beyond you. But I think that's one of the issues, that's one of the things that media is very good at doing, is kind of laying out a situation in which you don't think there's anything you can do. And in fact, laying out a situation in which you think you're on your own. And that everyone else is, you know, no one else thinks like the way you do. So I think that kind of atomization of people's view of the world is one of the most important things, actually, I think the media do. Because, again, when you look at it, when you look at, you know, issues to do with public opinion, one of my colleagues, Justin Lewis, wrote a book on this called Constructing Public Opinion. And he says when you actually look at it closely, public opinion is way to the left of where the media is. I mean, right, like in the recent healthcare debate, you know, most people, the majority or a plurality of people, you know, would prefer a single payer system, and yet that was never on the agenda. And if it's not in the agenda, people think if they hold that view, that they're kind of weird and they're kind of strange. Once you realize, in fact, that if the majority of people hold that view, well, it changes your perspective on how you can organize.
Our guest, Sat Jolly, you've just been listening to, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, which produces probably the leading producer of critical work on media seen by students in the United States, and maybe increasingly, I hope, the English-speaking world. Our telephone number here at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Call in if you'd like to join the conversation. Sat Jolly, I think the very first time I had you as a guest on the program, which was, a good 5 or 6 years ago, early on in the history of Media Matters, we've talked about one of your films that had just been made, or videos. I keep calling them films. It's probably not the proper term.
The DVDs. Man.
DVDs. Okay, there we go. I want to get it right. DVDs. And it dealt with the Middle East and the situation between Israel and Palestine. And it was probably the most stunning response I've ever had on this program, with callers calling in who were quite upset with what you said, and even raising the issues you were raising, let alone, you know, any commentary you might have in addition. And, you know, talk a little bit about MEF's history with covering the Israel-Palestine issue and what you've done in the past, how the response has been, and what your plans are for the future.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think our responsibility is to look at issues that don't get raised elsewhere. And I think the Middle East is, you know, kind of case number one on that. And it's been not even just the Middle East, but issues around Israel and Palestine. And, you know, it's case number one on that, or example number one. I mean, our history on this goes back away. We did a film. Actually, I think film is the right term, not DVD. So I think it's okay, actually, because film now encompasses almost everything.
Okay, good. I'll use that then.
Well, because, you know, there's almost no such thing as film that exists anymore. Even Hollywood films are, you know, produced digitally, so old-style films no longer exist. But we did a film in the late 1990s with, you know, the great intellectual Edward Said, and based on his book on Orientalism. And, you know, that was the start of looking at these things in a critical way. And, you know, and he lays out very clearly in the film and in his own work how our views of the Middle East, you know, are framed in a very, very particular way, you know, by the history of, you know, of imperialism, whether it's, you know, French imperialism or British imperialism or American imperialism, and that, you know, the ways in which we understand particular parts of the world are heavily dependent upon the stories that we have access to. And again, I think the Israel-Palestine conflict is, again, you know, example number one on that. I mean, I got into it because, you know, when I was teaching, you know, in my own classes, I would actually ask quite people what they knew about about the conflict between Israel and Palestine and Palestinians, and I was kind of stunned at what I found.
What did you find? Yeah, what was that?
Well, I do these questionnaires at the start of my classes, and what I found was that between 50% and 60% of my students thought that the Palestinians were illegally occupying someone else's land in the Middle East. The question I asked was, you know, who has been continually condemned in the United Nations for illegally occupying someone else's land? And you're thinking that at least people would know that, you know, that there is, that Israel has been involved in this, you know, now coming up to, what, you know, 45-year-old, you know, 50-year-old occupation. And I was stunned that, in fact, what people's views, with the people's understanding of this, and remember, this is at a, you know, good old liberal university like the University of Massachusetts, that, you know, 50 to 60% of my students actually had the, not just, you know, what wasn't, they just didn't know, had the wrong, in fact, had it upside down. And so I thought, how did this happen? How do people, you know, have this kind of understanding of such a key issue? And, of course, at that point, once you do that, then you've got to ask questions about, you know, okay, what kinds of stories are they exposed to? Mm-hmm. When, you know, what is the frame that they understand things in? And then you start looking at the media, at the American media, and the kinds of stories that are framed, or the way the stories are framed, and you quickly understand why people would understand the situation in that way, because the major fact of the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, that is the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza until recently, although Gaza is now just turned into a giant prison, but that the fact of occupation is what people don't know. And if you don't know the fact of occupation, then nothing. Then all the images you see have no context.
Why don't people know that?
Yeah, because the media don't mention the occupation. The media, the mainstream American commercial media, don't mention occupation. They don't mention the settlements. So they're actually just absent. And actually, one of the things I found on this, and I think people who look at issues around around ideology, I think one of the most important things to focus on is not only what's there in a story, because you can measure what's there in a story. You know, that's what content analysis does.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also what is not there. In one sense, I think the absences are far more profound and are far more important than, in fact, the content of what is there.
So you were raised in Britain and lived in Canada for many years prior to moving to the United States in the 1980s. Did you notice there's a different type of coverage of Middle East issues in other countries, or is this a pattern that's pretty much universal across the English-speaking world?
No, it's actually very specific to American media, actually, for good reason, which is, you know, Israel and Israeli public relations and Israel's representatives in the U.S. and its allies and its supporters. It's not just Israel's direct representatives, but also, you know, the political and economic elite within the U.S. who have an interest in making sure that the situation remains as it is. The American support for what Israel is doing is absolutely fundamental and absolutely key. Therefore, you've got to make sure, and not least in terms of the amount of money that goes from the United States to Israel, so you've got to make sure that here, above all else, that the debate is locked down, the debate is controlled. And it's very different, actually, in Europe. It's very different in Britain as well. In fact, in the film that we did, this was in 2003, Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land. Our comparison is between American coverage and British coverage. So we're not looking at something that is some, you know, far off, you know, left place. We're looking at, you know, how does the BBC, for example, cover this? And you notice actually, you know, a striking difference. And then the question is why? Why are Americans, you know, given a different kind of story around this than are people in the rest of the world? And again, I think the reason for that is there's a focus on controlling those stories. I'd like to say that, you know, there's actually two occupations going on. There is the occupation that's going on in the West Bank and Gaza. That's the military occupation. And then there's also the occupation of the American mind. There's the occupation of Americans' imaginations of how we might think about these kinds of issues. And in fact, we're updating the film, and the title of the new film that we hope to produce within a year or so, the title of the new film is going to be called The Occupation of the American Mind.
Our guest, Sat Jolly, you've just been listening to, one of the leading communication scholars in the United States, teaches at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, author of numerous books and articles, probably best known as the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation. You can go online to learn about this group, which is one of the leading, if not the leading, source of critical films on media issues in the English-speaking world today. Sat Jolly joining us live on the phones from Massachusetts, and it's great to have him here. Please call in if you have a question or comment at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. Sat Jolly, a lot of the work of the Media Education Foundation and your writings through the last decade dealt with the policies of the Bush administration and the federal government, and I think quite critically in a whole range of areas, both foreign and domestic. And I'm wondering your take from your vantage point on the Obama administration and the Obama phenomenon. What do you make of Obama?
I think it's a very interesting time that we're in. The best thing I've read on this actually is a piece by Chris Hedges. I'm not sure if you know Chris Hedges wrote a book.
Well, we've had him twice on the show last year.
You know.
Our listeners are well aware of Chris Hedges.
Okay. And he wrote actually a piece called Brand Obama. And I think what he said was, you know, Obama is a brand. And what he means by that is that brands, don't stand for anything, you know, like Coke or McDonald's or, you know, or Levi's or Apple. It's not that they have very concrete properties. They're an idea. That's what brands are, and therefore you can put a brand on anything. And Barack Obama is a brand, you know, his aim is to make us feel good. And I think that, you know, the election, you know, last year was, you know, I mean, that was based around this notion of hope and of change. If you actually looked at what Obama said he would do, when you looked at his actual policies, they actually weren't that. You know, he's a centrist. Perhaps even a right centrist. But he's a centrist. You know, what he said he would do about, for example, of Afghanistan, that was what he said he would do on the campaign. And so I think what happened with Obama was that people read into Obama whatever they wanted to read into him. He was kind of one of those, Rorschach ink blot tests. You know, if you wanted Obama to be a centrist, he was a centrist. If you wanted him to be a leftist, he was a leftist. If you wanted him to be, one of the in the tradition of civil rights, he was that tradition. Whatever you wanted, that's what brands do. Brands, the brands are kind of open that way, and they pull you in that kind of emotional way. And I think that's great to be elected that way. No, it's not great, but that was a strategy to be elected. You don't actually have to stand for anything. You just have to have an emotional connection with your audience, which is what brands do. And when you talk to brand managers, for commodities and for corporations, they're talking about our aim is to have an emotional connection between the brand, between the logo and the audience. And I think Obama got that in a spectacular way during the election. With enough people, not for everyone. And I think the problem he's facing now is the problem of ruling and the problem of governing when people have so many different expectations of it.
Let's go to the phone lines now. Our guest again, Sat Jolly from the Media Education Foundation. Let's start with line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Sat Jolly.
Yes. What do you expect from somebody from Massachusetts? Well, anyway, as I said...
Hey, we just elected a Republican.
I know you did. You all don't care nothing about the rest of the country. A lot of people and things need public health care. You all got yours. You don't care about nobody else and things. And as far as I'm concerned, I think Obama is governing just fine and thing. It's the people that's around him, which I think is a lot of them is racist anyway. They knew what his plans was when he was running for office. And another thing, when it comes to about students and things not knowing about the history of different things in the world, is because a lot of them going to college and a lot of them is stupid. They don't have no common sense or nothing like that. We have things on the TV about the Palestinians and Israel. Look what happened with President Carter when he was complaining about how Israel was treating the Palestinians. That's because Israel is into everything. Israel owned part of the media. Israel got lobbyists, Israel this, Israel that, And I'm not all the way against Israel. I'm against the Palestinian and some of the Arab people and things, not Arab, but the people that will not speak up, And this crap been going on. I'm 73 years old. This crap been going on all my life, And they get to a point where you're tired of it. The United States don't want to do anything, And when you got the Jews is running the media.
Well, let me stop you here, ma'am, and maybe let Sat Jolly respond to some of your comments, okay, and see what he has to say.
Sure. Yeah. In terms of Obama and the people surrounding him, I think that's absolutely right. He has allowed himself to be controlled by, the right wing of the Democratic Party. And I think it's actually up to those people who support him for some other reason to put pressure on him from other places, like from the left wing of the Democratic Party, even from outside the Democratic Party. And I think until that happens, then it's going to be kind of, business as usual in Washington. Until you have that social movement that can put pressure on him, that can give him cover, that can give him support, perhaps to move in some other direction that he may want to move in. But he's got to be able to know that that's a safe political way to go. That's one thing. Back to Israel. I mean, it's definitely not about, you know, the Jews controlling the media. That is not why we see the stories that we do. There's a much more structural reason for that. That's based on, you know, a much broader set of economic and political interests. Although, again, the caller mentioned the response to Jimmy Carter, and I think it's very, you know, it's very interesting. Here is, you know, a former president of the United States trying to open up the debate, trying to open up, have a different kind of way of thinking about that conflict. And the massive response to him, you know, was the major question was, you know, is Jimmy Carter, you know, an anti-Semite, and which is the way you shut down debate. So I actually think the Carter example is a prime example of how the media, you know, the frame the media use to cut down any kind of critical, you know, view of this. Which is, anytime you have anything critical to do with Israel, you're immediately, you know, labeled an anti-Semite, and that's an accusation that keeps a lot of people quiet, you know, because no one likes being called a racist. Again, and when progressive Jews raise these same issues, you know, they get labeled, you know, self-hating Jews. So again, it's a very absolutist way to think about, you know, how you understand a situation, that anything critical of Israel, you know, must come from somewhere else, rather than, in fact, from a lot of Jews I know, you know, the critique of Israel comes from their deep faith in the Jewish tradition and the belief in justice, the belief in democracy, the belief in universal human rights and not particular human rights.
Our guest, Seth Jolly from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and the Media Education Foundation, joining us live today on the phones from Massachusetts. Seth, before we go on, I do want to ask you about another comment the caller made about students today. And you've been teaching roughly the same length of time I have, perhaps even a few years longer. Have you seen much change in your students over the last two decades, quarter century, in terms of any particular patterns you've seen?
Not really. I think the caller talked about, you know, students being stupid. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone is, you know, inherently, not as a group, you know, inherently stupid or inherently bright. You know, what people understand is based on, you know, the kinds of backgrounds they have, and the kinds of experiences they have, and the kinds of frames for understanding the world that they have. And I don't think that has changed very much, actually, in the last 20 years or so. For me, my experience has been, when you can get people in the classroom and you can get them to think about these things which matter to them, when you give them another way of analyzing these things, that their eyes open up, that they're hungry for this type of knowledge, which they just have not had. Yeah, all through their education system as well. And in one sense, I think, it's, by the time people get to university, it's a little bit too late, to kind of deal with these issues. But I haven't seen that much change, I don't think.
Yeah, one of the themes you've already talked about, one of the issues you've already raised, is something that I discovered, you know, two of the last three weeks, I've had the privilege of traveling around the country with John Nichols, first to the West Coast and the Northwest, and then to Boston and New York the past week. And we've done probably, I'm guessing, 25 public events and maybe the same number of radio and TV events in these 2 weeks. And what's been striking in the question and answer period or in the interviews, almost uniformly, has been, for lack of a better term, the demoralization of people that we talk to. And it's somewhat related to the Obama phenomenon, I think, but not entirely. It's a much deeper-seated phenomenon as well. But just the sense that the palpable sense I get today from so many people, that it's just impossible to fight City Hall, that it's just basically the entrenched powers are so powerful and the system is so rigged and corrupt that it's really a waste of time almost to try to do anything in this country to make things better. I don't know if you sense that at all, but I'd be very interested to know how you deal with that, knowing that you, like me, share a tremendous sense of, ultimately, optimism.
I think that's been around for a long time. And in one sense, it comes from, you know, it depends on which day you get me. some days I'm incredibly kind of, you know, pessimistic, because it seems as though, I mean, again, what corporations, you know, have learned is, you know, what the left has never learned, which is the importance of culture. And the importance of ideas, and corporations and the right you know, have put all kinds of, you know, money and resources into making sure that, you know, the realm of culture is controlled. And if you can control the realm of culture, I mean, remember, this is the what I like to call the lesson of Confucius. Confucius was once asked what he would do if he were ever to run the state. And he answered by saying he would, quote, rectify the language. And if you asked him today, he'd say, you know, give me control of the media. And I think what he realized, what he meant by that was, you know, if you can control the language, you control the categories through which people think about the world. And if you can control that, you don't need police on street corners. You can imprison people within their own minds, within their own imaginations. That's the lesson of Confucius, which the right has learned and the left has not learned. And that's when, you know, that's when I'm in my kind of bad mode. At the same time, I always, you know, you talked about the pessimism and the optimism. You know, there's a famous quote by the Italian socialist Antonio Gramsci. You know, the phrase was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. You know, I think those are the two sides. You've got to, in one sense, the demoralization comes from a kind of clear analysis of what the situation is. And you've got to do that. You've got to have that kind of clear-eyed, you know, non-dogmatic, objective view of, you know, what we're up against. And that may be, you know, that may be demoralizing. At the same time, that's got to be tinged with the reason you have to understand those things is because you want to participate in the world. You want to be part of the world. And the optimism comes from that, you know, from the optimism of the will comes from that, you know, necessity that, in fact, I'm going to, you know, take part in the world. And so what I actually stress to my students is, you know, it's really important to understand the world, but it's really also important to use that knowledge and to use it in a fun way. That it's much more fun to be in the world and to be active and to try and change things than it is to kind of sit back and let other people act on you. And I think if you can do that, if it's getting past that demoralization, it's getting past that kind of, you know, that you're paralyzed by what you know. And that, you know, there's nothing you can do. There is something you can do, right? That's always the case. There are always things you can do, and if you don't do them, someone else will do them. So I try, and that's, you know, I don't want to have some kind of Pollyannish view of the world that says, yes, you can change everything, you know. But nothing happens without people taking, you know, without people, you know, collectively organizing and, you know, trying to intervene in that world. But I think that demoralization is part of what the media, you know, what the media agenda is. It's to make sure that when we think about politics, we only think in terms of, you know, the two right-wing parties that are in power right now, you know, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, and we don't think anything outside of that frame. And I think one of the things about that's happening with new media and with online stuff is I think people are starting to break out of that a little bit and starting to think of other ways in which they can organize themselves, other ways in which they can communicate with each other. I don't think the internet is going to be the place that's going to free us. The internet is a great place, is a tool that can be used, I think, for organization. And as long as we don't confuse those two things and think the internet is what will, you know, free the world because it's going to show us what's, you know, it's going to reveal the truth to us. It's not. The internet is going to be, it's under the same kinds of control as the rest of the world. But it also has a possibility, you know, for organizing ourselves and for getting some views out there that wouldn't have got out there before.
So, Charlie, what are the media you use to try to stay on top of the world, and maybe not only politically or in terms of journalism and news and public affairs media, but also, you know, entertainment media that you know, a part of your universe that help you, you know, stay sane and keep a keen appreciation of what's taking place in the world around you?
I think, you know, number one on that list is Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Again, I try and catch that as often as I can, hopefully every day, just because it gives you, you know, it kind of is a you know, corrective to this, you know, if you turn on the network news as to what's there, that it opens up, you know, another whole range of possibilities. I also read as much as I can on the web. I try and read foreign newspapers. I try and go to the Guardian newspaper in England as much as I can. That I would say would be one of my major media that I'm exposed to. And again, I actually think I learn more about America from The Guardian than I do from The New York Times, because it has a slightly different perspective on the world that seems very familiar. But I think, you know, people should, I mean, as long as, The most important part of this, because I get asked this question, I'm sure you do as well, by students a lot, you know, okay, where can we go for the truth?
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any one place you can go for the truth. I think the most important thing is to realize that there is no one place will give you the truth, and therefore you've got to go to as many sources as possible to try and get it.
What does that mean? I say that too, but at the same time, that sounds great, but what about the person who's working a job, has two kids, and, you know, doesn't have a couple hours to sort of comb the internet to find all the sort of really neat hidden away websites and then sort of fact check a bunch of them to see who she can trust or he can trust?
Well, I agree, not everyone has that amount of time. But I think even just that kind of cynical view of, you know, the what we're getting from the mainstream media, you know, comes from a very particular source. It comes from a very particular place and is a very particular way of thinking about it. That's one way. The other way, of course, is what, you know, what you and John Nichols talk about, which is, you know, we shouldn't have to rely upon that, which is to say it's up to the consumer to make, you know, to get as much information as possible. I mean, that's what I do at this particular moment. But, of course, in an ideal, you know, in the world in the future, what we need to work towards is a situation in which the media that we're exposed to continually and in which journalism does that job. That is the role of journalism. The role of journalism isn't simply to, you know, to pass on what the powerful think. The role of journalism actually is to search for the truth, and it's to give us some perspective on that. And that's what's being lost. I think that's, again, in your own work, you know, we've got to battle not just to try and get, you know, look at these other places on, you know, go to media sources on the margins, but how do we change what is the main place where people get their news? And it's a struggle at that point around the media, and a struggle around who controls the stories that we're exposed to.
And Sud, we only got a couple minutes left. I noticed that on the Media Education Foundation website, there is a tribute to Howard Zinn, who just passed away last week, and who the Media Minutes program, but right before we went on today, had a long clip of his talking about the importance of democratic media in a free society. And I was just wondering, who are some of the other figures beside Howard Zinn that have, and I know he's been instrumental clearly for you and for Media Education Foundation, but who are some of the other writers and thinkers that have had a lot of influence on you and your understanding of the world? If people want to sort of get, do some of their own reading, who's influenced you?
Well, Zinn, obviously, I mean, I think Noam Chomsky has been fundamental in keeping alive a certain, you know, critical view of the world. For myself, you know, I'll give a more personal answer to this, which is, you know, one of the most important people in my own kind of intellectual development is a cultural theorist called Stuart Hall. Hall, well, you know, was actually he was at the center of, you know, founding the field of British cultural studies. And Hall always said, you know, he said, and even though, you know, people think about cultural studies as this kind of esoteric and theoretically, you know, obtuse place, that wasn't Hall. And Hall always says two things which actually keep me going. He said, on the one hand, you know, the role of intellectuals, and I think he would say the role of anyone, is to understand the world the best way it can be understood. You know, you've got to understand, you've got to use science, you've got to use, you know, the latest research to understand the world the best it can be understood. And once you've done that, secondly, you've got to then be able to, you've got to communicate that to a broader audience. You've got to make those ideas a material force. You've got, and if you really believe in intellectual life, that shouldn't be left at the doors of the ivory tower. That ideas and intellectual vocation is too important, you know, to be limited just to the classroom. You've got to get outside the classroom. You've got to get into, you know, into the world. And in fact, the distinction he makes that's been important to me is, you know, I don't think of myself as an academic. You know, when someone says, you know, that's academic, what it means is it means it's irrelevant. I think of myself much more as believing in the intellectual vocation. So being an intellectual, not an academic.
Such Ali, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to kick me out of the studio for our next show. It's been a delightful hour with Such Ali, the Executive Director of the Media Education Foundation. Thank you so much, Such, for joining us.
Okay, pleasure as well.
Have a great week. I want to thank Kyle Crowell for working the board, Melissa Trentz, my producer. Remember, everyone, 2 weeks from today, make sure you come to the live showing in the Siebel Center of Media Matters with John Nichols. I'll be back next week with Barry Lynn talking about monopolization in the economy. the disaster presents and what we can do about it. Until then, have a great week, everyone. See you later.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today will be partly sunny with a high of 28 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a low around 15. Snow moves in on Monday with a 40% chance in the afternoon, a high of 29, and several inches of accumulation possible with a 90% chance in the evening, a low of 22. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580.